Media Masters with Paul Blanchard.
Welcome to Media Masters, a series of one-to-one interviews with people at the top of the media game. Today I'm joined down the line by Tom Rogers, the media and technology executive whose influence can be felt across the communications industry. Tom revolutionised business news coverage worldwide through the creation of CNBC and MSNBC. He changed the face of TV consumption at TiVo, where he brought Netflix and Amazon first to TV screens. An Emmy Award winner for outstanding contribution to the development of television, he was inducted into the Broadcasting Hall of Fame. Tom, thank you for joining me.
Thanks for having me.
I mean, you've operated at the nexus of media, technology and public policy for more than three decades. Of all of the things you've been involved in, what have been the biggest challenges and what's also given you the most satisfaction?
Well, the things that are the biggest challenges are the things that have given me the greatest satisfaction, whether it's been on Capitol Hill reforming the telecommunications laws, or it's been at companies facing change. My specialty has really been an industry in transition and operating at the cutting edge of that transition to try to drive change and be prepared for a new era. And so those are always great challenges, but getting through them are always a big satisfaction. So that cutting edge area where change is what you take head on is what I have found both daunting and satisfying.
Could you take our listeners through a run through of your career? I mean, how did you get started on the journey?
Well, I was always fascinated with television as a kid. I subscribed to TV Guide at a very young age and would have them stacked up on my bedside table, never throwing any of them out. And I actually got fascinated with the one part of the magazine which very few people probably read, which was about the FCC and what was going on in Washington regulation relative to TV. And it caught my eye at a very young age. And that had me interested in television from a public policy point of view. And I focused on that somewhat during college and somewhat during law school, and had jobs in the part-time jobs in the media space, including writing a syndicated television column during summers in college. I became a lawyer and had an antitrust case involving television stations and the television industry, but I always had a hunger for actually being at the center of it all and being able to create public policy around communications. And so after a couple of years at a Wall Street law firm, I wrote a letter to the new chairman of the House Telecommunications Subcommittee, who had just taken on that role. We got together and I met with the staff director, and they hired me as a young lawyer on Capitol Hill in charge of media policy for the committee. And that was a tremendous experience, probably the defining career move in terms of being able to go on to do the other things that I did in my career.
What came next?
Well, the key transition that the media industry was facing in the early 80s when I was on Capitol Hill was how cable television was emerging clearly as a powerhouse. But the communications laws were really only written to deal with telephone and broadcast. There really wasn't a federal policy relative to cable TV. And so spent a couple years developing a Cable Communications Act that could govern the development of what was clearly going to become a powerhouse industry. And having drafted that act and it passing, I left Capitol Hill in 1986, having met along the way Jack Welch, the legendary chairman of General Electric. And interesting, in the mid-80s there, all three major television networks, NBC, CBS, and ABC, changed hands, which involved a lot of congressional regulatory oversight of those major transactions, with all three broadcast networks having new owners. And I got to meet Jack Welch in the midst of it. And when it was all over, he said, call me up. And he said, there's somebody I'd like you to meet. And I said, okay. And I said, who? And he said, guy by the name of Bob Wright, who is head of our GE Capital business. And interestingly, the same subcommittee I worked on had jurisdiction over the Securities and Exchange Commission. And I kind of thought he was introducing me to him for that purpose. But I sat down with Bob, and he told me confidentially that he was about to become the new CEO of NBC. And that Jack said, I knew everybody in the cable industry from writing the Cable Act, and they very much need to get into the cable business. And so I joined NBC and became, in fairly short order, the first president of NBC Cable. And from there, spent 12 years at NBC developing cable business, among other businesses, but most notably CNBC and MSNBC.
And when you first became president of NBC Cable, it was said that you legitimized cable itself at NBC. Was there a cultural thing before you arrived that they didn't quite respect cable until you arrived?
Well, yes, there was great animosity between the broadcast and cable industries then. You know, when you look at the cable industry today and all the major broadcast networks own major cable properties, in fact, are the biggest owners of cable properties. Back then, it was a us versus them thing. Very difficult within NBC itself, which was overwhelmingly a broadcast company. And there wasn't a lot of support for our driving ourselves into cable. People used to say to me, you know, it must be pretty schizophrenic being a president of a cable division inside a broadcast company. And my answer would be, no, I don't think so. And neither do I. So it was a very non-synergistic relationship at first, given the number of people who were gunning against NBC coming into the cable industry, not only within NBC, but within the cable industry itself. So it was a tough effort to drive the company into that. We started by attempting to put together a major deal with Ted Turner, who owned CNN at the time and was a great cable pioneer, somebody I had known from Capitol Hill. And he came to me at what was a difficult financial time for him in the late 80s after the late 87 market crash, and was really looking for a major partner. And I thought it would be a terrific vehicle for NBC to begin driving into the cable industry, and Ally itself was such a major force within the cable industry. We put together a deal to merge certain aspects of NBC News and CNN, and for NBC to become a 25% stakeholder in Turner Broadcasting. But Jack Welch and Ted Turner didn't really hit it off when we put them together. And Jack came out of that meeting and said, I think we're going to go it alone. I'm not so sure I want to be a shareholder in a cable consortium with Turner at the top. So we set out to figure out how to create our own presence in the cable industry. And I knew very well that the cable industry antibodies against us as a broadcast company coming into the cable space were such that we were not going to get carriage agreements to be a general news service competing against CNN. So working with John Malone, who now the legendary chairman of Liberty Media at the time, the known as the king of cable, is the CEO of TCI, the largest cable operator at the time. Working with him, who saw the value of a broadcast network and all of its program capability coming into the cable industry and helping the cable industry improve its programming, which of course had been very much a key element of the public policy thrust when I was on Capitol Hill, creating a law that would encourage greater development of the cable industry's programming depth and diversity. We decided that financial news would be a better angle than general news and get a lot less resistance from the cable industry and be able to make the case we were going to very much upgrade the quality of business television and transform business TV with everything we had to offer. And so we chose that path, and it ended up in the end of the day, transforming the nature of business news.
I mean, your imprint on the cable business has obviously been massive. Tell us about the journey of actually creating CNBC and MSNBC in terms of, you know, was it an advantage in a sense that, you know, you had NBC's infrastructure there, or was it a disadvantage because you guys were mature players and maybe a bigger company lacks the agility, that sort of buccaneering mentality of cable as it was back in the day?
Well, when it came to CNBC, we knew that we couldn't have the kind of cost structure that a television network had. We had to be more efficient, much more nimble, not burdened with the costs that were imposed on the broadcast station and broadcast network world, in part because of very expensive labor contracts. And so we decided to put ourselves in New Jersey, outside the geographic jurisdiction of the labor unions. It allowed us to be a non-union shop. We looked to be much more scrappy. There was a financial news service called FNN, Financial News Network, out there that was viewed as very, very limited programming. So we knew what we had to do to look better, be smarter, be differentiated. But we also knew we needed to be much more efficient. And as a result, while there was certainly resource within NBC that we could leverage, we weren't really able to leverage the power of the company. We were really out there without the major shoulder of a broadcast network. And it showed up in a couple ways. You know, I thought, let's use the Peacock on CNBC and the Peacock police who controlled the use of the trademark within the NBC broadcast apparatus were horrified that the broadcast station affiliates around the country would revolt if we did such a thing. So that was a no-no. I remember sitting down with the legendary president of NBC Entertainment, Brandon Tartikoff, who in its heyday was responsible for the Thursday night lineup that was killing it on TV. And Brandon didn't really get cable at all. And so I sat down with him and he said, you know, I just don't get this. You know, you guys are going to lose $30 million in a year building this thing. Do you know what I could do with $30 million to put against made for TV movies and other things? And I said, Brandon, but you got to understand, we got a different model. We are going to consciously try to make sure 99.7% of the television audience at any given time isn't watching us. And he said, that's absurd. And I said, no, but that's a cable model. A 0.3 audience in a specialty area can create an enthusiastic following that you can put pricing against that will ultimately make it extremely valuable as a broadcast network. And he just couldn't get his head around that. And it was very hard for people who grew up in only thinking of mass audience and mass entertainment to think about niche and small niche services being able to make the kind of impact that CNBC eventually made. Now, when it came to MSNBC, which was 6 years later down the road, it was a totally different story. There, the leverage of NBC really began to take hold in a significant way. First, the way we got agreements to carry MSNBC in the cable and satellite world was a regulatory change had been made, where prior to this, when CNBC was launched, cable companies got to carry broadcast stations for free. They could just retransmit them without paying for them. And a legal change occurred that said now broadcast stations could negotiate with cable operators for a fee, which became known as a retransmission fee, for it to be paid for a cable operator's right to retransmit a local broadcast station, say Channel 4 in New York. And all of a sudden, that began to create some real leverage on the part of NBC as a broadcast player, having something that the cable industry badly needed. And the cable industry was standing up saying, we're not going to pay cash for these broadcast stations. No way, no how. We're not going to do that to our consumers. It's been free. It should continue to be free. And some of our broadcast brethren, most notably CBS, decided to go head on into that argument and say, we're charging cash and we're going to get it. And I took a different tact based on having spent a lot of time negotiating with cable operators. I said, you know what? You can have our broadcast stations and you don't have to pay cash for them. But our price is going to be you provide a new carriage of a new channel for us. And that channel is not, we're not going to call it general news because I still knew the sensitivity around CNN. We're going to call it a news talk channel. And you're going to carry that and you're going to pay us for that. And that's going to be our fee for you getting our stations. So there you began to see the muscle and leverage of being a broadcast player help us get that through. And it originally started as a channel called America's Talking. And that's how we got the original real estate for what became MSNBC. MSNBC was a further chapter in that story.
It's incredible because you're a real innovator. And it reminds me of the old joke of, you know, the big corporate board that says that when they want to hire an innovator, and then you go to them with an idea and they say, yeah, we like these innovative ideas, but unfortunately they've just not been tried before. You know, was there a stressful element to this as well as an exciting element that, you know, there's real risk? I mean, CNBC and MSNBC are institutions now, incredibly well respected. We take them for granted. And I mean that as a compliment, but, you know, back then there was no guarantee of them succeeding. They could have failed. And, you know, it takes real courage to start these things, does it not?
Yes, it was something that most people were betting against. There were a lot of naysayers. What the hell is this dinky little channel doing business news from NBC? You know, what is America's Talking compared to CNN? There were a lot of derogatory comparisons. It wasn't like we were entrepreneurs raising venture capital money. We had a giant company in the form of GE behind us, funding us. But at the same time, GE was an earnings beast. GE did not like losses at all. And so there was always that pressure of, hey, look, we're going to fund this thing, this thing better turn. And while Jack Welch could not have been a bigger supporter of these cable efforts, there were many within the GE apparatus who were like, hey, you know, I just don't get this. I mean, what are we pouring all this money into this? Look at the broadcast world. Look how big it is. GE wants to be number one or number two in all of its businesses. What is it doing fooling around with this startup cable stuff? Fortunately, the voice that mattered was the one at the top, and we got the backing to continue to drive it forward.
I mean, in the same way that the traditional broadcast networks might have been slow to anticipate the changes that cable would bring, do you think that the cable giants were slow to anticipate the changes that digital streaming would bring to viewing?
Absolutely. The cable industry blew it, just absolutely blew it. And we were in the middle of the conversation where they had the ability to understand what was going on and basically decided not to do anything about it until it was way too late. Now, the cable industry has been saved by how important high-speed broadband internet connections have become to everything that we do, including streaming content. And that business has allowed them to continue to have a very significant growth engine, despite their mishandling of the video landscape. But their mishandling of the video landscape was very significant. And we saw this with TiVo. We had developed the digital video recorder, and with that, changed the whole way that television could be consumed, with an interface that could lay out all your television for you and capture it very easily, so it was available on demand on your fingertips, coming from all your traditional cable and broadcast sources that the cable and satellite operators were providing you. And we spent a lot of time trying to be the core interface for the cable industry, because they had very clunky channel guides that were really terrible ways of giving the consumer what we take for granted today by way much more of an on-demand, easily accessible television experience. And then we upped the standards that we were providing much further with Netflix and Amazon as computer services, finding their way as streaming services to the television screen through the TiVo box, and showing people how these new sources of television could become really terrific enhancements in terms of what was there. And we told the cable industry, look, this is the future, and you can put it all together like nobody else can. All the traditional broadcast and cable channels, all your new video on demand content that cable spent a lot of time trying to develop, and these new streaming services. And we showed them how YouTube and the wild, wild west of internet video, TiVo was integrating it all under one roof, and how we would sell this at retail and people would have a phenomenal experience. But to really make it mass scale and protect and preserve the cable industry's role as the central force in video distribution, this is where they had to go. And the cable industry couldn't get there. One, they thought that a third party like us providing the look and feel of their viewing experience, the user interface, the user guide, the entirety of how that was framed was too strategic. They better develop it themselves. Well, for the most part, they weren't good at developing it themselves. It was not something that really they began to even get close to getting right till a couple of years ago, as opposed to this being available to them a decade ago. They looked at Netflix and they looked at Amazon as the enemy, kind of just like they looked at us as broadcasters coming into the industry when we were developing CNBC. One saw it as a problem to keep away, not to embrace, and two, they belittled it. The CEO of Time Warner at the time called Netflix the Albanian army and looked at it as if it was a totally inconsequential programming force that, of course, the cable industry would defeat. And so everything we did to kind of bring that forward, we were successful actually when it came to the midsize and smaller cable operators. They embraced TiVo, the interface, the streaming, got it out there. But the big guys who were the ones really defining the look and feel of the cable industry, the Comcasts, the Charters, the Cox, they couldn't get there. And as a result, a massive industry developed in entertainment streaming outside the cable bundle, away from them, and they basically allowing their former top-notch video business to decline and become less and less significant to their business, and they know it will continue to decline. As I said, though, they have that broadband business, and whether you're Netflix or Google or whoever you are in the new streaming content world, that broadband pipe is the fast pipe that everybody needs. And so they have a new lease on life through that.
I can remember that TiVo was massively ahead of the game in all things, not just sort of cutting the cord with the cable companies, but my predominant memory at the time was that ad skipping was a major controversy at the time.
Yes, ad skipping was something that the industry worried about. Our view was, look, you are going to have services with no ads, which there already were with HBO and Showtime. And we said, look, many more of those are going to develop. And obviously, that's where the best of entertainment programming has gone today, whether it's Netflix or Amazon or HBO Max or Disney Plus. So the answer to that was better targeted advertising, which you're beginning to see somewhat when it comes to the new so-called advertising supported video on demand. But we actually came up with some key means of dealing with ad skipping. We knew that people, you know, to be consumer friendly, you couldn't just force people to have 3 or 4 minutes of ad in between all their content. It just was not a satisfying consumer experience. So we would create ways for people, when they stopped on an ad for something they like, to be able to go much deeper and spend, instead of 30 seconds, get 2 minutes of information, and maybe have the opportunity to click with the remote control and buy the product. Or if they were fast forwarding a commercial and it took 5 seconds to fast forward, have a billboard screen that flashed during that 5 seconds that gave some impression of what the underlying ad was, so that it had some impact. And other tools that were intended to deal with the entire business model of television. But there were, again, broadcasters, instead of wanting to adapt to a more friendly, targeted, advertising, appealing approach to the consumer, tried to defend their existing way of doing things, which ultimately, again, gave way to non-advertiser supported entertainment content being the place that most people now want to go for the best content on television.
It's amazing, because it's like going through your career, you're innovating, and then they then become the dominant traditional players, threatened by a potential other innovation that you're then innovating on. I mean, you know, can TiVo, and indeed cable, you know, platforms you've been hugely involved in, can they now survive alongside the likes of Netflix and Amazon?
The thing that TiVo started out doing, which was putting all television under one roof with universal search, whether you were looking for Netflix or Hulu or CNBC or CNN, having the ability to find anything under one roof through a universal search, so that all of your television was delivered in one easy to find interface, kind of like what Spotify did for music. It took every piece of music in the history of the music world and put it all under one user interface, and allowed you to have the experience of taking anything you want, customizing it, personalizing it, creating your own playlist. And TiVo did that for TV. TiVo, after we sold the company, I don't think has the ability anymore to regain that position of being able to deliver that to the world. I am surprised that Apple, for instance, for that matter, Amazon, players like that are not much more focused on becoming the universal interface player for delivering the TV equivalent of Spotify. I think relative to their individual content contributions in Amazon Prime or Apple TV Plus, not that they don't produce some good television, they do, but the consumer need of creating the TV equivalent of a Spotify, not exactly that same model, because Spotify has the underlying rights to all that recorded content, but being able to create an interface which gives you the experience of being able to find anything from anywhere in the video world with one search, where you can personalize and customize how you want your TV in the equivalent of a Spotify playlist. That's just not getting the focus of the major companies in the way that I think it should. And it's a huge hole in the whole TV consumer experience.
I mean, you were at TiVo for 11 years until it was sold successfully to Rovi. Is it difficult when you do move on from businesses to not want to sort of go back and get involved? Or do you have a mental discipline that sort of, you end the business relationship and you wish them well, but you look upon it from afar? How does it actually work with all of these successful ventures that you've been involved with when you leave? Is it difficult to do so, or is it easy?
pretty easy. I've always felt what I wanted to get done, I've gotten done, and good time to move on, recognizing that the landscape is always changing. There are new challenges to conquer, take on the next one, and figure out how to bring it forward. And I feel as if I did that with the news and information world, with revolutionizing television through what we did with CNBC in particular, television news, onto the entertainment world with what we were just talking about with TiVo, and now taking on the sports world, which is being hugely disrupted, and to me is the next great place to think about all the new dynamics that exist out there and how sports television needs to adapt to them.
Absolutely. You preempted very masterfully my next question, which is to talk about what you're doing at the moment. I mean, you're chairman of Engine Media. That puts you at the heart of yet another innovation, booming sector, esports, gaming, and so on. You know, what are the big challenges there? What's top of your to-do list at the moment?
Well, what's going on in the sports world is very relevant to what we were just talking about with the decline of the cable satellite bundle and the vast popularity of streaming entertainment programming. And the decline of the cable satellite bundle is at the heart of sports television. What makes that cable satellite bundle cost $100 a month or more is the cost of sports TV in it. And the fees that are charged to cable and satellite operators and then passed on to consumers by the sports networks and the regional sports networks are really at the heart of why you can recreate your own television service off the back of Netflix and other streaming services much more cheaply. So as the satellite and cable bundle declines, the subscriber fees that are supporting sports television decline with it. And with that, there are fewer people who are watching sports on television. And in fact, the audience ratings of sports TV have declined fairly precipitously for most sports, even though they have come back later in COVID, and we were sports starved for a long time. And even with people still at home, able to watch a lot of television, those ratings have declined. And so sports TV is got to reinvent its model. When you have declining ratings and you have the key subscriber fees coming from cable and satellite as people cut the cord declining, you got to find new sources of revenue. And the area that people have been looking to for that is sports gaming and sports gambling. Sports gaming and gambling are an interesting way to ride the direct-to-consumer new model that's developed in the entertainment streaming space, where the Netflix of the world and all are directly charging consumers for their programming as opposed to it coming through a middleman bundler like cable or satellite. And sports needs to figure out how to acquire direct-to-consumer fees as well. Sports gambling has been thought to be a very interesting area, and you're seeing all the media companies ally one way or another with what's developing as a very competitive sports gambling landscape with several mobile gambling licenses in those states that have lit it up. The majority of states have not lit up mobile gambling yet. And so that is keeping it from being a national opportunity, much more of a state-by-state rubric, not legal in New York yet, although possibly coming in the relatively near future. We at Engine Media, that I'm executive chairman of, have a somewhat different approach. We think that social games of skill are a way to tap into how people think about sports on television and how they've always thought about sports on television as a way to really develop that next source of truly meaningful revenue in sports television. And what I mean by that is fathers watching with sons, buddies watching sports with their friends. They're all playing along in their head. What's a quarterback going to do next? What's the next play on the field going to be? How's the game going to play out? And they're smack talking back and forth, you know, what's going to happen? Who knows the game better? And that's been the case of how sports has been watched on television socially since the beginning of sports TV. Well, what we've done with Engine Media is our WinView unit developed a play-along format for people to play along in real time, where on their mobile device, and everybody watches sports with their mobile phone in their hand, they're getting questions about what's going to happen next in the game. And you can compete anonymously in a room, say, of 20 or 25 people, or you can play against friends and family. And you can play for free, or there are entry fees where you can play for money. And you can't bet on a single proposition because that would be gambling. But it's more Jeopardy style in a room where you're putting forward points based on how much you think you'll know the answer, and you're competing against 20 or 25 people, and a game is one quarter of a football game or one quarter of a basketball game. And that kind of game of skill competition we think is tied to the live social experience of how mobile and sports and social and gaming all come together. Those four quadrants overlap into this kind of form of interaction. We think will be a very important next generation aspect of how sports on television develops. And we have a lot of patents related to this whole realm that also apply to sports gambling. So we feel we will very much participate through our intellectual property in sports gambling. So that's part of what Engine Media is about, and very much a part in my mind of how we tackle the challenges that sports TV are currently facing.
I mean, you've got an incredible array of opportunities, and as executive chairman, a lot of responsibility. So I suppose my next question is, how do you choose what to focus on, given that, you know, the buck ultimately stops with you? There's only a finite number of hours in the day. I mean, what does a typical week look like in terms of, you know, how in the pie charts, what are the segments and what do you choose to focus on? Inevitably, as the leader, whatever you choose to focus on is a choice to focus on that rather than something else, which could be equally pressing.
Absolutely true. And whether you're CEO or executive chairman of a public company, you got to really make sure you're making the best use of your time relative to what the organization needs. And, you know, that inevitably comes down to allocating resources to where you feel that they are best employed, making sure you always have the right people for the challenges you have, aligning yourself with other companies in the ecosystems through partnerships, ventures, et cetera, making sure you're constantly rigorously evaluating whether the strategic path you're on is the right one and the adjustments you need to make in order to take into account changes in the marketplace and evolving realities. You got to be enough in the weeds that you truly are understanding all the dynamics of the business, but stay enough above them to be able to have a perspective that those who are grinding it out in the individual units of the business don't necessarily have the ability to see, given their day-to-day undertakings. So that's a challenge of managing a company. Very important, I think, as anything is in any of these challenges I had, is articulating your differentiation. Why do you matter in a world of many other options and many other approaches to how people are providing content or providing their element of the TV ecosystem, making sure yours is understood in a differentiated enough way that people, when they look at you, say, ah, I understand why you matter. And that's a constant refinement of strategy, but very important in articulation of it. So all your constituencies, from investors to employees, understand what that is. I'm also chairman of a fascinating company in the digital advertising and marketing space called Captify, which has the largest repository of search data outside of Google, some 40 billion or so pieces of search data a month that it aggregates across a vast array of publisher sites. And that business gives me a great deal of insight into what is going on in the hugely important and vastly expanding digital media world that is increasingly becoming also a video world as well, not just text-based and billboard ads, but fills out what my perspective and insights can be on that aspect of the media marketplace.
Which bits of your professional life do you enjoy the most? Because, like, you know, I can do my bookkeeping, but I don't enjoy it. I view it as a necessary evil. I like the creativity and, you know, hiring people and sort of seeing people getting motivated and delivering results and building something. If you had to sort of pick out the best bits of your job and your professional life, what is it? What are the natural synergies, the bit that when you see that appointment coming up in your diary to do something, you actually think, oh, wow, that'll be the highlight of the day?
I'm not sure I can narrow it down to one. I do have a kind of a sideline that I really enjoy, and that's being editor at large at Newsweek, which gives me the ability to step back and be a bit of a media content creator myself, writing columns about the public policy world and talking about those on television, which I get to do when my alma mater on MSNBC. And that is always fun because it is different than being a business guy. So I look at those opportunities as one to put on a different hat, have my brain work a little differently, and put out there in the marketplace of ideas, thoughts on politics and public policy. When it comes to the business world, I think my favorite thing is hearing some success from somebody in the business, the companies that I oversee, and something that we've talked about, thought about, hoped we would be able to put in place, seeing them getting it done and be able to do the attaboy, way to go. That's really great. Kind of celebrating for somebody who has worked really hard an accomplishment, so they know that they matter. It's not, as I was talking about before, how a company matters, but that they matter. Because in the end of the day, we all get up and go to work and want to feel as if our contributions are meaningful. And you got to recognize how important it is for people to feel that what they do day in and day out matter. And when I get those opportunities to see that weigh in and tell people that that's something to be proud of and something I'm proud of them for having done, those are the best times.
You've worked with legislators at Congress passing communications laws back in the day. I was going to ask you about that in terms of the expertise you've gained. Can the new tech giants be regulated in the same way? I mean, I read earlier today that you've come up with an innovative proposal to deal with hate speech on social media, which is subjecting the Post themselves to an independent arbitration review.
Yeah, that is an example of trying to put out a public policy idea in an area that people seem to be grasping for how to handle a vexing political and social problem, the responsibility of social media platforms, and how do you do it so that the government isn't regulating speech, but these giant social media platforms aren't the arbiters of truth in and of themselves, and all the criticism that that brings on them for being the ones who decide the fate of what is appropriate or inappropriate speech. And so I came up with a proposal to create an independent approach that would allow for conflict resolution on a fast track basis, that would offer a solution that is neither the government nor the social media platform being the end all be all on that. And actually trying to work to get some public policy support for it. But when I was in Congress on Capitol Hill, going back over 30 years, there was obviously a huge degree of partisanship, but you did have the ability to work across the aisle. The Cable Act that I worked on was a bipartisan piece of legislation that emerged with major Democratic and Republican support. In fact, at the time, the House was in Democratic hands, the Senate was in Republican hands, and we came together on a very important piece of legislation. It's so much harder today because the polarization is so much greater, and the ability to block anything, particularly where you have a Senate that for anything that isn't put through on budget reconciliation, basically requires 60 votes. Something as difficult and complex as social media, even though it is one of those very few issues where both Democrats and Republicans are calling for something having to change, coming at it from different perspectives, but neither liking the status quo, it does get very hard under today's political conditions to see how anything meaningful gets done.
You've also overseen iconic media brands like New York Magazine. Can these print titans make the digital jump?
Well, some have. New York Times, Wall Street Journal, they're doing damn well with their digital subscriptions. And they have Donald Trump to thank for a lot of that, I think, as the entire news industry does. I don't think there's the one thing that love and hate for Donald Trump has done is brought a whole lot of people into being much more intense news consumers than was before the case of the Trump.
The so-called Trump bump.
Yep. And, you know, many in the news media deny that. But I think it came at the right time where digital transition was absolutely critical and many of them took advantage of it. I think, like with any industry, you have the big scale players who can continue to build off of their scale and continue to drive it, and smaller players not having the resources to do so and not being able to put up the price value proposition to develop digital subscriptions, which seem to be the key to having a print business that can transition to digital profitably. It becomes tougher. And, you know, you see the New York Times being able to pour resources into puzzles and cooking and really deepen their franchise to all kinds of interests, which are beyond the ability of many of the smaller print players to do. But I'll tell you, being involved with Newsweek, both in a not just the editorial sense that I mentioned, but through Engine Media in a business sense. And they are seeing 60 million unique users a month coming in and engaging with their content. That's much more than Newsweek at its heyday as a print franchise ever did. So the transition's possible. It's much tougher when you're relying solely on ad revenue as opposed to those that are really able to derive a subscription business. And the bigger players in the print world are doing that, but that's a rare air at the top of the print industry.
I mean, you've done so many incredible things. Do you have any big unfulfilled things that you want to achieve in life? Any professional challenges? Are there any unticked boxes left on the to-do list professionally?
Well, I keep watching the industry and looking for what needs to be dealt with by virtue of the challenges and transitions that it's going to have to go to. Everything I mentioned about sports television is going to hit news television too, because they are hugely dependent on those same cable and satellite fees that the sports world is. And the news industry needs to figure out an answer to how it acquires direct-to-consumer fees in a world where the entertainment is going streaming and sports may have a different kind of answer. Where does that leave news in terms of support? So I've begun to return to my original challenge of the news industry and thought about what needs to happen there to safeguard the television news sources, one, and two, how to make them interesting and more accessible to younger demographics, where as successful as the large television news franchises have become, they are overwhelmingly old in terms of their demographics at 60 years and older. And video news needs to figure out not only a better economic model, given all the challenges, but it needs to find a way to be more interesting to younger demographics.
About a year ago, we had a gentleman on the podcast by the name of Paul Royal, and he's the editor of the BBC's 10 o'clock news, which is like our flagship bulletin on the BBC every weeknight. And he was saying that the biggest problem they have as a schedule bulletin is that every single viewer, almost every single viewer, knows the news before the newsreader, the anchor, has actually even started to sort of say what the headlines are. You know, in the old days, you'd watch the news to find out what the news is. But now it's completely different, isn't it? You already know what the news is. You're just looking for a different angle, a level of analysis, whatever it is. And trying to get that mix right is the biggest challenge. Otherwise, what's the point?
Well, that's why in the US, there really isn't any truly primetime news. All the news channels are commentary, analysis, opinion, debate. That's been the case in TV news for a long time, with mobile alerts and people getting news instantaneously to rehash it 6, 8, 10 hours after people have heard the news is not value for the consumer. The problem with that is people tend to be stuck on one particular channel of analysis, commentary, and opinion, and don't tend to get a full perspective of analysis and opinion, because there are very few of us do what I still do, which is TiVo through many, many news programs to capture all sides of what's going on. If we could assure that could happen more often, we'd have a much more informed citizenry and far less polarization. But the consequence of what you point to, that nobody wants to rehash what they already know, and having gone to opinion and commentary formats, is we don't have a full array of that content getting to people. They get stuck on one point of view and don't hear anything else.
A couple of questions on your leadership style. How has it evolved over the years? You know, you've been leading many organizations through lots of profound change. You know, what have you learned about leadership yourself as you've done this for many, many more years? And also, obviously, a big part of leadership is choosing those who you hire, those that you're going to surround yourself with. What qualities do you look for when you're hiring? What qualities do you admire in others where you think, right, that's the killer attribute there. That's the one that I want on my team.
Well, there are a whole lot of attributes that are important in terms of whether somebody's good for a particular position and good fit within an organization. One that I prize very highly is the ability to articulate, the ability to persuade, the ability to listen to what somebody else is saying, take it in, and then be able to respond in a very articulate manner to what you've heard. I it's a huge deficiency of our education system, and probably less so in Britain than here, but certainly in the United States, people don't learn to speak. Even in law school, you are barely trained to how to command a room, how to connect to an audience, whether it's 10 people in a conference room or a few hundred people at a conference. And it's just such an incredible skill. It's critical to being able to read an audience, and that could be an audience of one and how you build a relationship, or a group of colleagues who you're listening to and trying to get them to understand what you know in a way that is compelling enough for them to embrace it. Or it's a conference where you're trying to get people to buy into your company in a sense, in terms of what it does and what it stands for, and appreciate the differentiation of the company that you see. So eloquence is really meaningful. I find it the hardest thing to find among employees. And when you can find people who are willing to, one, listen, two, think analytically, and three, can express themselves articulately and express that reasoning and logic, you tend to have a winner.
And what's been the biggest disappointment of your career? What's been the biggest setback?
Well, the biggest disappointment by far is the role that I played in the polarization of the country, where Roger Ailes came to NBC as the president of CNBC. He was the third of the presidents we hired to be the operating head of the CNBC business during my tenure as president of NBC Cable. I spent a lot of time convincing Roger to come to NBC. That channel I mentioned, America's Talking, was just starting then, and used that as a way to really convince them, look at this canvas you could build on. We gave him the credibility to come to in the cable industry. And then when we started MSNBC, and he left the company because for a number of reasons, but not the least of which was MSNBC, a joint venture with Microsoft, was going to be managed by NBC News and not him. Therefore, the whole America's Talking effort that he had come to program was no longer going to be his to program. And he left. And he was, we put him out right there for Rupert Murdoch to hire to start Fox News. And with that, Roger Ailes created a hugely successful Fox News, which to this day, I believe if we hadn't hired him at NBC, and there were a lot of times during my discussions and negotiations with him, I could have easily said, this isn't going to work, and reported back to Jack Welch that it wasn't going to happen. And starting MSNBC and casting him out there for Rupert to pick up, and the creation of Fox News, we played a real role in the creation of Fox News, and with that, all the political polarization that ultimately led to the Trump election and the worst of what has been spewed out in the public marketplace in the last year, particularly the last 2 months of the Trump presidency. And when I look back at that, obviously couldn't have known all that was going to happen, but there was a moment in time there where Roger Ailes never would have become a cable network president, but for those conversations. And if those conversations could have taken another turn, I often wonder, would the whole politics of the country been different? Would we have ended up in a very different, less polarized place? And that is my biggest regret and darkest thoughts about my career.
There used to be an old TV show, didn't there, called Quantum Leap? And it made me realize, I sometimes think of those Quantum Leap moments where if you could leap into your old self 30 years ago and change history by making a different decision, you know, would you do it? I mean, I'm obviously talking to you from London, England, and our television news stations are heavily regulated. If a Conservative politician is on the news for 3 minutes, then they have to, by law, put a Labour politician on for the same airtime. We look at Fox News here through an English lens, British lens, and we're just absolutely aghast because it's almost tantamount to brainwashing. I mean, I've seen these clips of Tucker Carlson and Laura and all of these people, and it's just, it really does play the part, doesn't it? I mean, they don't seem to acknowledge, perhaps deliberately so, of that incredibly divisive nature of politics, of the fires that they're stoking.
Well, we used to have what we called the fairness doctrine in this country, which had a similar impact. The fairness doctrine no longer exists. And it goes to the point I was saying before, if we could assure that people saw pieces of all news channels, as opposed to just being stuck on one, we'd have a far less polarization. But when you get sucked into the vortex of a particular channel, particularly one that plays fast and loose with the facts, you end up with what we have today, and very hard to think of how to cure it.
Last question then. What have you done in your career? What's the one thing that springs to mind of which you're most proud? And frankly, it's a challenge because, you know, without wanting to flatter you, you've obviously achieved so many things in so many different areas. But is there one particular thing that you're most proud that gave you the most joy?
Being able to have my career and see three kids grow up to be as grounded and as focused professionally and as curious and interested as they are. It's how do you manage a career while having a family where you want to have the right influence and see the kids develop in their own right? And the thing I'm most proud and fortunate to be able to say is I got three kids who vastly exceeded any expectation I ever could have had as to how well they would proceed down that path.
Tom, that was a hugely interesting conversation. Thank you ever so much for your time.
Thanks for having me. I enjoyed it.
Well, wasn't that amazing? It was created and produced by Podcast Partners. They're really lovely people and rather good at all this podcasting guff. Find out more at podcastpartners.com.